It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network. After years of bees dying off by the millions, the most recent U.S. Census of Agriculture indicates that America's domestic honeybee population is at an all-time high. But our next guest says the new numbers don't mean the end of our bee problem. And those honeybees, they're just part of the bee story. An expert on pollinators and bee conservation is here to break down what the new numbers mean for the environment and the limits of domesticated honeybees as pollinators. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done things like plant things in your garden to help wild bees, native bees? Do you keep honeybees in your backyard? Do you have questions about conservation efforts? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Susan Carpenter is the Native Plant Garden Curator and Gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Susan, it's taken me a while, but I'm finally wrapping my head around the idea that when we talk about bees, we're talking about two stories that we have to keep both of them in mind. There's the domesticated honeybees that we may be more familiar with. Then there's the wild native bees. How important is it to remember both sides of that story?
Well, it's pretty important because sometimes we just kind of think bees are bees and everybody loves bees and wants to help bees. But if we really don't understand kind of what those two groups are, we'll have a little harder time helping them. So, the honeybees are a domestic animal. And of course, like any domestic animal, if you put more of them in the landscape, there'll be more of them. And that's kind of one of the things that we've heard about recently with the described as kind of a recovery of bee populations. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all the bees are benefiting because the wild bees are in some cases not well known as to what their populations are. We do know, of course, that some of the wild bees are declining, and that is a problem. That's kind of the two sides of the story.
Let's look at the domesticated bee, the honeybee population side of things. First, give us the basics. As I understand, these are not actually native to the U.S. in the first place. Give us the basics on the honeybees.
Right. Well, most of the honeybees that are domesticated here in the U.S. or in the North America are native to Europe, and they were brought over in the 1600s. Mainly for wax, for reasons of their wax production, but of course now they're busy here as an agricultural industry. Really, the honey industry is quite important, especially it is important in Wisconsin, and they are a perennial species, so they live from year to year, and as part of that life cycle, tens of thousands of bees maintained in hives, they create honey. And the function of the honey is really to maintain their populations from the growing season of one year to the growing season of the other year, when they would be able to go out and forage again for nectar and pollen out in the landscape. So they create the honey for the winter, and of course that's where we get honey. We harvest some of that off of their hives, and then they would be living from year to year, but in recent years, there has been a lot of winter kill or die off in the winter of the honeybees. And then also there's some diseases and pests and so forth that can harm them even during the summer. So they would have to be replaced year on year at that point. So that's kind of how the honeybee life cycle works and how the honeybees are important in agriculture. They're also important for pollination. You may have heard of commercial honeybees, where the hives are shipped around in the country. So when the almonds are blooming in California, almost all of the commercial honeybees are in California pollinating that crop. But it only lasts for a few weeks, and so then they have to be shipped in other places, perhaps for apples or other crops that are grown in large fields in kind of a monoculture situation and needing pollination all at that same time in that same place.
You mentioned those die-offs. People talk about hive collapse disorder and things like that. When I saw this new U.S. report and the honeybee population being up, I thought, Well, great. That means that collapse disorder is over. Those die-offs are over. Not necessarily. It may be just that we're importing and starting more colonies of bees to make up the numbers.
It looked in the recent article, it looked as though the losses were still at a pretty high level, but the they were being replaced, as you would say if you had a different animal like chickens. You were growing in an agricultural setting. If you had chickens getting sick, you might replace them with more and more chickens in order to build up your numbers again.
Susan Carpenter is with us. We're talking about bees. Susan is the native plant garden curator and gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum and an expert on bee conservation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you pay attention to either of these categories of bees in your life? Do you have bees that you raise to get honey? Do you plant things to help native species of bees? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Susan, let's turn to our native bee species, and that's plural, right? There's a lot of different kinds of bees around North America, a good number of them here in Wisconsin.
Yes, there's about 500 species of native bees in Wisconsin alone, and that includes a lot of diversity. So we have a diversity of sizes of bees, the time of year when they're active, different life cycles. Some are ground nesting, some are cavity nesting, some are solitary bees. So they don't have colonies. They're just reproducing males and females on their own. And others have colonies. So like bumblebees would be a good example of that, where a colony establishes. But it's only a single year colony, an annual colony. So it doesn't go from year to year. Just the queens carry through the winter. They are dormant during the winter underground, and pretty soon they'll be emerging and starting new colonies for this year. So we have a whole variety of species of bees, and that isn't even counting all the other pollinators that are important for pollinating all of our plants. And the native bees are active in pollinating native plants, of course, because they've evolved with them for thousands of years, but they're also effective at pollinating crops. So there are certain crops that are better pollinated by some of our native bees rather than honeybees. So those are the kinds of things to think about. All that diversity of bees kind of corresponds to the diversity of plants. And plants are really going to be the basis of all the food webs and all of nature that we're taking care of and that we are stewards of.
Of those 500 plus species in Wisconsin, are there some that we're worried about that are threatened or even maybe endangered?
Yes. Well, we have just to take bumblebees, for example, because bumblebees is a real familiar bee to everyone. And we have 20 kinds in Wisconsin. So there is one that's federally endangered, and it is the rusty patched bumblebee that there's quite a few of them they're found in Wisconsin. I would say there are quite a few of them, but they're found in Wisconsin, and many, many people, just ordinary people learning about bumblebees, are documenting bumblebees across Wisconsin, and particularly that one. So yes, there are other species that are being considered for endangered or are of concern because of declining populations. And that's just within those 20 species of bumblebees. There are other species which we really don't have any information and much information at all. So those would be ones where their story is kind of hidden right now, and we need people to be watching for them and learning about them. And really anybody can begin to learn about these organisms, especially if you have the kind of habitat you're taking care of, plants, native plants, and other ornamentals or vegetable crops where they'd be drawn to. You can learn a lot about these just by observing, watching, documenting in your own spaces.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having this show and letting me ask a question. I have what I believe are minor bees, that come to my yard at one particular corner every year, and I am just absolutely woefully ignorant, and I shouldn't have said every year because some years I don't get them, but I'm just completely ignorant about what to do about bees that come out of the ground and how to take care of them. And am I going to, you know, would I be drowning them if I'm watering my lawn? I mean, just anything basic even that you can explain would be really helpful.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. And Susan, I believe it's minor, like M-I-N-E-R, like mining in the ground because they live in the ground, right?
Of course. Yeah, that's a whole group of ground nesting bees. And a lot of our, okay, so out of our 500 species of native bees, about 85% of them are solitary bees. And the majority of those are, so we're talking about hundreds of species, are ground nesting bees. And what you'll see, as probably Mary is seeing, are like little, they look like little anthills or little volcanoes on the ground. And that's really where the bee has dug out the soil. So it surrounds a little hole. And the hole is about the size of a pencil. So if you see bees coming and going through those, and we have some areas here that we see those regularly. So I'm thinking it might be the same, might be a similar species to what Mary's seeing. We see them in the spring. So the example I'll give is a ground nesting bee in the spring. And of course it's snows and rains and, you know, there's water falling there. That doesn't seem to bother them. Their life cycle is such that they're coming out, they're emerging from the soil, from developing throughout the past year, and they come out and the males and females mate, and then the females collect pollen and come down into those holes and they lay an egg on a ball of pollen. And then that's it. She continues to do that maybe 30 or 40 times. Some of these bees are only out for a few weeks, like while certain plant is blooming, like the willow, something like that. And then that's it for their life. Then that little egg is eating that pollen and developing into an adult bee throughout the year. And then it emerges next year and the cycle repeats. So basically, I think that if you see that in your yard, it might be a pretty temporary thing and you don't need to worry about it too much. I mean, I wouldn't like go plug up all the holes or anything because that would just make it hard for them to dig back out. But I would have plants that are blooming early. If you can see which plants they're using, it might be good to plant more of them. That would help probably. But they might, you know, they'll fly around the area. So they might not just be using things from your own, you know, immediate spot around the hole. And they're not, during the rest of the year, there doesn't seem to be anything, you know, any problem at all. The holes kind of close up usually, and you don't even notice that anything's going on there. But underneath the ground in those chambers, those little bees are developing for the next year.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Hope that helps. Susan Carpenter is with us, native plant garden curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum, talking about bees, a honeybee population increase, and native bees, and what we could do to help them out. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a farmer or gardener, what species do you rely on to pollinate your plants? Do you have questions about pollinator populations? Do you garden with wild bees, so maybe butterflies, other pollinators in mind? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Susan Carpenter, native plant garden curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum and bee conservation expert. We're talking about pollinator populations, including honeybees and native bees, over 500 species of native bees here in Wisconsin. What it all means for the environment? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a pollinator garden? Have you ever done that no-mow May thing? Are you planning to this year? Do you keep bees in your backyard? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I was wondering, what impact do the honeybees have on the native bee population in Wisconsin?
Oh, interesting question, Bill. Susan, what do we know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it depends. And what it mainly depends on is how, what area we're looking at. So for example, habitat. Habitat is usually described as the floral resources, so all the flowers that bees can use. And if there's a abundance of flowers, an area that's just full of flowers that are valuable to pollinators, then there might not be very much impact of honeybees of being in with the native bees in that area. But if the habitat is poor and there's not very many flowers, we do know that honeybees can, like a hive of honeybees could displace 30,000 of those small bees that I was describing just a little while ago, the small native bees that are solitary. So because they're using the resource. There's also evidence because honeybees can be affected by mites and other pests, but through the mites can carry honeybee viruses, and some of those viruses can be transmitted to, say, bumblebees or solitary bees, either directly or indirectly through the flowers that they visit. So there are some issues about that, and of course, a lot more that we need to learn and know about, you know, those effects. But I would say, you know, the things that we want to do to promote all bees would be to provide lots and lots of food, basically. So that is flowers that the bees will use. And not every flower is created equal in that regard, but there's many, many resources for finding out which flowers would be the best to grow throughout the season to have blooming all season long so that all those bees at those different times can find food.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. And Susan, that leads right up to what I wanted to ask next. Are there, you know, flowers, maybe native flowers that are good catch-all things that many people around the state could use to help out those native bees?
Yes. Well, actually, the best thing to think about is we have so many different kinds of bees. We need all different kinds of flowers, too, because some flower structures are really open and any bee can visit in there or any other pollinator. And some flowers have a very specialized structure and only certain pollinators are kind of co-evolved with those. So diversity is the main thing. Have a diversity of flower types, a diversity of flower blooming times, a diversity of, well, of course, we have a diversity of habitats, so we need to match up the plants we're growing with the kind of habitat we have, whether it be open sunny areas or wet areas or whatever the conditions are, we need to match up plants for that. But there's a native plant for every situation. And then we kind of need to have some other factors like nesting spots and like leaf litter and bare soil in places and hollow stems, places for colonies to be established, like maybe old chipmunk holes and things like that. So kind of a natural area of the garden, natural gardens are really helpful for the habitat side for the bees.
Let's go back to our callers. Andy is with us in Fort Atkinson. Andy, hello.
Hi. Now, I've got a 20 by 30 place that I've been covering with black plastic, and I was wanting to plant some native flowers there. Can you give me, some resources that I could, get a hold of to get seeds for the spring?
Sure. If you are planning to go with seed, one thing I'd suggest is go to the DNR website and type in native plants as your search. And there's a whole page there which has lists of nurseries. It has information about the plants. It has information about contractors who are helpful in this area. For a 20 by 30 foot area, you'd probably want to, if you were doing it with plants alone, you would probably want to get about 600 plants to put in there. That sounds like a big job, but it's a lot of fun. With seeds, this time of year, if you're putting down seed, you're going to probably not, there are certain seeds that need to kind of go through winter in order to germinate. A lot of the flowering seeds need to do that. So you might not, if you put the seed down right now, it might not have that amount of time to stratification, to stratify before germination time. But there's some grasses and some of the flowering plants that would be able to. I would suggest getting a seed mix that matches up really well with your conditions there, what your soil type, and you can look into the native plant nurseries and they have specific seed mixes that correspond to different areas, like semi-shaded, dry soils, sunny, dry areas, and so on. So you'll find something that matches up, and you don't have to buy the seeds in that mix, but you can use those lists as a, you could buy them in those mix, but you could also use those lists as kind of a guide for you.
Thanks for that call. And just our last less than a minute now, Susan, how about things like city and highway maintenance departments? Are there things we can be doing on our roadsides to help these bees?
Yeah, well, that's really general to everywhere that's important, and roadsides and railroads are someplace I see this a lot, is we have to protect the bees from pesticides. Frankly, that is one of the biggest risk factors for all of our bees, including honeybees and all the bees. So not using pesticides, and then using native plants. You might not be able to use, as diverse a mix in a roadside situation, but I've seen it done. I've also seen a lot of native grasses used in that situation. And I think if we can think about all the different places that we have stewardship roles, like community gardens and faith centers and so on, all those kinds of places are places where we can introduce more native plants into the environment and have a beneficial effect for bees.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Susan Carpenter is the Native Plant Garden Curator and Gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum, an expert in bee conservation. We're talking about the recovering honeybee population and challenges facing native bee populations here in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Spring is having a fitful start here in Wisconsin, but we're ready to start thinking about, maybe dreaming about, picnics and outdoor potlucks. What better dish to bring along than a pasta salad? Now, some people might say pasta salads are bland, unimaginative. That gives the whole side dish a bad rap. But today's Food Friday guest has made it his life's mission to give pasta salad its day in the sun. Not literally. It might go bad if it sits there all day. He's with us to share recipes and tips for lifting up your pasta salad. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite kind of pasta salad? Secret ingredient you like to add that makes yours extra special? If you are anti pasta salad, what is your problem with it? Maybe our guest has a fix for you. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tom Jackson is a chef and creative director and co-creator of the food media brand Twisted. His cookbook is called Cool Pasta, Reinventing the Pasta Salad. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you got it. Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for that intro. You hit on some pretty crucial points, I must say.
Now, you write in your book, Tom, that you're on a lifelong mission to rescue pasta salad from that bad rap I mentioned. Why? What made you dive headfirst into the pasta salad?
It's a big question. Okay, the first would probably be the dish itself and my personal experience with it, right? Because I'm sure at some point we'll come on to the disparity between UK pasta salad experience and US pasta salad experience. Of course, pasta salad was born in the US. And then secondly, I'd probably say it was kind of the secondary meaning to the title, really, but also to the word cool. Like, why, like, where did it all go wrong for pasta salad? What even is cool? Like, why have, why have the big wigs decided that pasta salad's, not trendy anymore? And I think it's deserving of, I think dishes that kind of represent that kind of divisive yeah, well, divisiveness just need investigating a little bit, need poking at. And that has always fascinated me. So I so yeah, sure. My lifelong mission. I'm gonna draw a line under this book and hopefully I've completed it.
Now this is a good book for me, Tom, because I usually like pasta salad when other people make it. When I make pasta salad, for a variety of reasons, it's not good. The texture, the flavor of the pasta, the material doesn't stick to it. And reading your book, I see the multiple things I'm doing wrong to my pasta salads. Let's start with that texture. When we're making the pasta for the pasta salad, what do we need to do to make sure it isn't, you know, gummy or oversaturated or whatever?
Yeah, sure. So like texture is like the guiding principle behind the entire book, right? So everything that we're doing is pointing towards texture. The first thing you got to do is remember that, pasta is essentially a sponge for liquid, right? So one of the biggest faux pas out there, and I've read it on countless different food websites and you know, notable food publishers, they say overcook your pasta for pasta salad. That is terrible advice. Please do not follow it. And this is why, right? If you were to overcook your pasta salad and you were to rinse it, which I'm sure we'll come on to a little bit more, rinse it, what that does is it cools it down and it changes the starches without getting too sciencey on it. Basically, it will change the way that it eats in the mouth. So, you know, if it's undercooked and you rinse it, it might go crunchy. But you have to remember that pasta salads are designed to rest a little bit. They're designed to get to know the other ingredients around them. And all of those ingredients contain moisture. So the best thing to do for texture and to get it right is to use al dente pasta. And obviously you can ignore that if you hate al dente pasta, but I guarantee you after 20 minutes, half an hour, by the time you come to serve or by the time you arrive in the park, you're going to have the buenissimo texture that you're really looking for. And I guess the second one, which we've kind of touched on, the M word, I'm going to say it's mayonnaise. I think that for me is one of the, especially here in the UK, I do believe that that's the root cause of the bad rap over here. I think that does deteriorate the texture, not least if it's left out in the sun, like you mentioned, that's the worst.
I do like mayonnaise a lot, maybe not as much in pasta salad. Okay, if I want to start a punch up, I think among food writers, Tom, ask them what's the best way to cook pasta, salt, oil, rinse, all that stuff. Is there like a main model you use for cooking that pasta that's going to go into the pasta salad?
Well, the interesting thing about, so usually for hot pasta, you'd use a big pot. I mean, this is a rule of thumb. You'd use a big pot of water. It's, you know, it's not as salty as the sea. That's also bad advice. But it's pretty salty, right? You dip your finger in it if you've got asbestos hands, and you taste it and it tastes salty. For pasta salad, you don't need a huge pot of, well, for pasta salad, you don't need a huge pot of water, which is great because it can come to the boil a little bit quicker. And the reason is for the majority of the recipes in the book, not all, but for the majority, you're going to be rinsing the pasta to a certain degree. And you can do that a little bit. You can do it a lot. You can rinse it all the way down to room temperature or air temperature. So you can use less water, provided that the pasta is covered and you're keeping things moving. That's all good. Don't put oil in the water. That's bad advice, whether pasta's hot or cool. I'd say that's kind of it. But one thing you do need to do and think about, if you are rinsing your pasta, you do need to salt the water a little bit more heavily. As the pasta's cooking in the water, it's absorbing that salt content in the water, and it's becoming delicious. So you might need to compensate. And there's a little guide in the book, but, you know, everyone should really use salt to taste, of course. That's how I cook pasta for pasta salad. I find it a little bit easier and less stressful. Cool pasta generally is less stressful than hot pasta.
We are talking to Tom Jackson on this week's edition of Food Friday. His cookbook is called Cool Pasta, reinventing the pasta salad. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have strong feelings about pasta salad, pro or con, a favorite recipe, a question for our guest. If you make bad pasta salad like I do, join in at 800-642-1234. Tom, we know revenge is best served cold, I guess at fridge temperature. What's the best temperature to serve most pasta salads? Is it like right out of the fridge temperature, room temperature? Where should it be?
Yeah, so I like to call it air temperature. But yeah, sure, room temperature. Generally speaking, because I think, you know, pasta salad tastes best in an alfresco location. So yeah, I'm going to go with air temperature or room temperature. So many things, you know, I'm sure, you know, when people have left a pot of soup that's super hot, right? I know that everyone's really hungry. Everyone wants to eat the really hot soup. But if you taste it, or you put it in your mouth at least, you're not tasting a huge amount. If you leave it to cool down 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you'll notice that you're tasting a huge amount more. And that's just a simple, you know, biological thing, right? So eat it at air temperature. It's the same thing. Like, there's a spectrum, right? If it's super hot or if it's right out of the fridge, it's not going to taste as good. So I think you should be ideally eating it fresh, once rested, at air temperature. Friends should be there. You know, you should be near some grass or some flowers, maybe. That's when it tastes best.
Let's check out a recipe. You've got one that you've shared with us. We have it at WPR.org/food. This is a great one in Wisconsin. We love corn and stuff here. And this is a pasta salad called the Corn One. Tell us about this.
It's, you know, I was strapped for names. It was actually a late entry into the book because I'd realized I had a few corn concepts, right? And I knew the book was going to be heading out to the States. And I was like, well, it'd be criminal not to include a corn one. So that's how I landed on the name. And it's a really, really simple recipe. There's not heaps of other ingredients in it. Some of my friends that have made it have, you know, added stuff and, you know, go for it. Really, it's all about the corn and the seeds in it, which are toasted like super dark. So there's pumpkin seeds and sunflower seeds in there. And there's mint and then there's Parmesan. So it's a little bit of a play on elotes, which is obviously a very popular dish across America, but originated in Mexico, which contains cajeta cheese, which is vaguely similar to Parmesan. And it's just so, so simple. So I like to use one of my favorite tools in the kitchen is a NutriBullet or Power Blender, right? And you just whack the cheese in there, blitz it up, super, it takes 2 seconds, whack it in a bowl with lemon, olive oil. So you don't make a vinaigrette. It all dresses in the bowl, get the pasta in, and yeah, the corn you just toast in a pan until it's really dark and toasty. So you get those like roasty, toasty, kind of sweet notes. There's some dried oregano in there, which is, a really, really good dried herb. So that's one of my favorites. I took that to a friend's barbecue and it was the first dish to go. So I can vouch for its popularity. And I've made it heaps of times since developing it. So I recommend it highly, Wisconsin.
And this one has fresh herbs in it. Now, the main recipe has mint, but you say you can substitute basil. That started behind the scenes argument with me and producer Rochelle Wilson. I said, of course, I'm going to sub in basil for mint. That's going to be way better. She disagreed. I don't know. How do you settle that argument?
I mean, you know, there's a reason it's not in the ingredients, right? Or is it in the ingredients?
Mint was the main one, and then basil was the substitution. Yeah.
Oh man, I know this recipe so well. It's a sub out. It's, you know, it's really up to you. But my preferred and the driving herb for me is fresh mint, which is one of my favorite herbs. And I like to use it in abundance. So you know. But lots of people don't like fresh mint. You know, it's quite an assertive flavor. But I think it works super, super well with all of those like roasty notes in the salad. And it's interesting because, you know, like if you look at that recipe, it doesn't look like a traditional pasta salad. And I think that's something I'm trying to change. I'm trying to demonstrate the breadth and diversity, both in, you know, the way they eat and the flavors, but also the way they look and because I think that changes the serving suggestion, right? It changes how you eat it and in what context, which is really important. It's a really cool recipe. And yeah, I'm honored to have it on the site. And I can't wait to hear what people think. Basil or mint, whichever.
We've got that at WPR.org/food. Tom Jackson is with us, chef, creative director, and co-creator of the food media brand Twisted. He's with us on Food Friday to share advice and recipes from his new cookbook. It's called Cool Pasta, Reinventing the Pasta Salad. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gotten creative with a pasta salad recipe yourself? Do you have a pasta salad dish that is, like Tom's was, the first one to go when you bring it to a get-together? Hey, mayo, pro or con in pasta salad? There's no wrong answer. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up, pasta salads inspired by sandwiches or that can be eaten on sandwiches. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Tom Jackson about his new cookbook. It's called Cool Pasta, Reinventing the Pasta Salad. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you come from a culture or a family that eats a lot of pasta salad dishes? Is there a special family recipe that you love to go to? Are there herbs, toppings you'd like to add into the mix? Do you need help salvaging your pasta salad game like I do? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Harry is with us in Milwaukee. Harry, hello.
Well, hi there. What a wonderful conversation you're having. And my question is about the type of pasta. Is it all interchangeable? Is the recipe that you use, does it need a specific pasta? For the only reason I ask that, when we make one from James Beard, and it calls for tri-colored rotini only. So is it interchangeable, or is it you need to keep that?
Fantastic question, Harry. Tom, choosing the right pasta for a particular pasta salad recipe.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so hey, Harry. Yeah, great question. I'd say, well, first and foremost, you know, James Beard, fantastic award, but I just think the tri-colored pasta is for the pictures, really. And what I would say in my book is you can use, so we exclusively cook bar one recipe with dried durum wheat pasta shapes. So that's your bow ties, your penne's, everything that you find in the supermarket. It's all good. But one thing we do need to think about is the texture. So if you're making a salad that has some, you know, chunky vegetables that you've roasted in there, you might want to go for a slightly smaller shape just to give you that contrast. You know, the idea is like when you're eating risotto, right? Risotto is one of my least favorite dishes. I apologize to everyone that loves it out there, because it's quite samey, right? It's the same texture in every mouthful, and I want contrast. I want, you know, different textures happening. I want stuff on top. So, you know, you can use multicolored, non-multicolored bow ties, penne. You know, if it's like this, a similar size shape, you know, as in like small, medium, or large, then I think all of those really should be interchangeable, because, you know, shapes are fun. And, you know, you don't want to get hung up on eating something delicious because, you know, the shape isn't the one that it says in the recipe. So I'd absolutely say go ahead and experiment with whatever you got, provided it's not wildly different. You know, if it's a long pasta shape, then maybe that's not quite right. But yeah. So yeah, you do you, I reckon, Harry.
Harry, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom, you've got a lot of sandwich references in your pasta salad in Cool Pasta. Some of your dishes are inspired by sandwiches. Some are meant to be eaten on sandwiches. Tell us the sandwich story behind a lot of these recipes.
Yeah, well, maybe that's a dedication to mayonnaise. All of my sandwich references. But yeah, one of my favorite chapters in the book is called Great Sandwiches. Of course, they are not great sandwiches, with the exception of one recipe. That one recipe is it's a brick chicken recipe. It's inspired by a recipe from Lebanon in Tripoli, where giant couscous is steamed and then fried. And then wrapped up in a Kobez wrap, like a Lebanese wrap. So it's an authentic recipe up to a point. Mine is non-traditional. It was very much inspired by that, but yeah, features some other ingredients that wouldn't feature in the original recipe. But you know, that's also a serving suggestion. I appreciate that, you know, pasta wrapped up in bread might push the carb conscious over the edge. So It's a serving suggestion. But yeah, the rest of the recipes in that chapter are all inspired by great sandwich eating experiences that I've had. And I think that chapter kind of encapsulates the way I like to cook, because I love drawing inspiration from other places, I guess. You know, I love cooking traditional recipes. But it can be quite heavy sometimes, because you're under the weight of so many years of history, and there are so many countless ways to do it that it can feel a bit overwhelming. So I'd say, generally speaking, the recipes are fusion recipes. And in the case of these sandwich recipes, what they do is it's pretty simple. They take the constituent ingredients from that sandwich and they apply it to a different carbohydrate, which is in my case, pasta. But I do it in this isn't a mashup. It's I think carefully about how the ingredients might manipulate around pasta instead of, you know, in a sandwich. So it's not as cut and dried as, oh right, he's just, you know, taken that bologna sandwich and chucked some pasta in there. It's a little bit deeper than that, I'd like to think, and hopefully I've given you some tips and some intro materials to kind of guide you through the thinking. But yeah, it's a bit more high concept, and yeah, I love it. It's super fun.
Food Friday. Tom Jackson is with us talking about his cookbook, Cool Pasta, Reinventing the Pasta Salad. Well, speaking of sandwiches, I've come to love a good tuna melt. And so I'm like going through your book. What's the first recipe? A tuna melt pasta salad. Tell us a little bit about this guy.
Yeah, right. So actually that recipe probably should have sat in great sandwiches, but it lives in a different chapter. It's one of my favorites in the book. One of the reasons is the timing. So, you know, sometimes when you're developing recipes, they don't quite work because, you know, the timing's out of whack and, you know, you're taking too long to wait, do one thing and something else is deteriorating, or, you know, and it's just fussy. In this case, kind of by the time you've made one element, the other element is ready. And one element is a super simple kind of tuna salad. So, I like to use oil packed tuna, but you can use whichever tuna you like. And in there's lots of black pepper. You know, I like to think of tuna as kind of like a, you know, it's an assertive flavor, and not everybody loves it. I actually don't love it all that much, which is saying something, because this is one of my favorite recipes. But yeah, it kind of acts as a backbone for all of the other, it adds body to the recipe. So you've got a tuna salad with parsley, lemon, lots of lemon zest, toasted black pepper. And then on the other side, you've got these crispy beans, and that's where the melt comes in, because we're using Parmesan to toss with these beans with lots of rosemary and capers. And all of those ingredients become crispy. Crispy rosemary is delicious. Crispy capers are delicious. And crispy beans are really exciting. Kind of like mini fluffy jacket potatoes. Do you call them jacket potatoes over there?
No.
Okay, fluffy potatoes. Let's
okay,
say.
Great. Okay, I was like, I don't even know what that is. Okay, great.
Yeah. Anyway, so one of the reasons why it's the first in the book is because it really kind of encapsulates everything that the book's about, which is interesting texture. And when you eat the two together, it's really exciting. There's a little bit of curry powder through the beans, which makes it taste a little bit interesting and different. It's really, really great. And again, for Harry, this is the shapes there are interchangeable. So it's kind of like you could use up to six different shapes, as long as they've got frills on the edges and they catch those little flakes of tuna. That's when you can have some fun with the shapes that you've got. So love that recipe. Another great sandwich. I hopefully that's the first page that people cook from, and then they work their way through.
We have less than a minute left now. If somebody wants to wing it, they've got the pasta. What's a good base for, you know, a few ingredients to throw in and you're going to come out with a pretty good pasta salad?
Sure. Well, let's assume that you've got nice pasta or the pasta you love. Good olive oil is kind of non-negotiable. I don't think you should be making pasta salads with neutral oils, so like vegetable oil and sunflower oil, etc. I think a really nice olive oil is pretty key. You don't necessarily need to use that for cooking the ingredients that are going in the salad, but for a finishing oil, I think that's a really delicious flavor for pasta salads. Acid is absolutely crucial. Lemon is in so many of the recipes, both juice and zest. It's such a good friend of pasta salad, whereas lime, for example, has a super tough time. So lime's out. But yeah, other acids like vinegars are delicious. I use about four or five different acids in the book. That's key. And then herbs. I mean, fresh herbs are in almost all of the recipes. In the corn one, we've got fresh and dried for that kind of contrast. But yeah, if you've got fresh herbs and, you know, salt and olive oil, then all you really need is a seasonal vegetable, or you can just jump into the pantry and grab some of those jarred wonders, you know.
Excellent. Tom, yeah. We'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, yeah, I'd rather be nowhere else. Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Tom Jackson, chef, creator of the food media brand Twisted. He was with us on Food Friday to talk about his love of pasta salad and his new cookbook, Cool Pasta, Reinventing the Pasta Salad. We've got one of those recipes, the corn one. That's the name. You can find it at WPR.org/food. Make it this weekend. Let us know how it went. Today marks a milestone in American literature that keeps you up all night. Hint, they're all going to laugh at you. As reported at History.com, this is the 50th anniversary of the publication of Stephen King's first full-length novel on this day. In 1974, Carrie was unleashed on the world. Spoiler alert, things go badly for the people in the book and in the movie based on it. But things went pretty well for author Stephen King. Carrie was a bestseller. King followed it up with ever so many novels and short story collections, including Salem's Lot, The Shining, Cujo, Misery. The list goes on and on. Just the other day, we talked about a new list of great American books from The Atlantic magazine. King's novel, The Stand, showed up there. So, happy birthday, Carrie, but I'm probably going to skip the party. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Conservatives in the U.S. had a major victory in 2022 when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. The ruling was made possible by President Trump's appointment of three judges, bringing the court to a 6-3 conservative majority. Now, in this election year, the GOP is in an awkward position as national polling shows that most voters support at least some degree of abortion rights. Republican congressional candidates in some states are in the position of pledging support for some abortion rights in spite of past support for overturning Roe. Trump-endorsed Wisconsin Senate candidate Eric Hovde said yesterday he supports the right to make a choice early in pregnancy. As far back as 2012, Hovde had advocated for the reversal of Roe v. Wade in past campaigns. We're taking a look at how abortion is being talked about leading up to the November election, especially by Republicans, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How important an issue is abortion to you when you're voting? Is it the most important issue or one of the most important issues for you? What are your thoughts on how Republican and Democratic candidates are talking about abortion? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jessica Waters is an assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University. She's an expert on reproductive rights law and policy. Jessica, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot of polling out there on the issue of abortion. Jessica, what can we glean from that when it comes to figuring out what Americans and American voters think about the issue?
Well, I think we can glean a couple of things. One, it's chaos, right? And we knew that this would happen post the Dobbs decision, because the federal protection that we had around the abortion right at least created, however you feel about abortion, it created a level of consistency across the states. In a post-Dobbs world, we don't have that consistency. And in every state, the procedures for, at this point, obtaining an abortion are different. But also the procedures for putting things on ballots and for elections are different. So it's really hard to predict with any degree of certainty what's going to happen, particularly in the swing states that we know are up for grabs in November.
One of the things that prompted us to have this conversation now is this ruling from Florida's state Supreme Court, two rulings actually saying an abortion ban earlier on is going to go into effect, but a ballot measure will be on the November ballot that could liberalize abortion laws. In some states like Florida, abortion will literally be on the ballot. How big a factor could that be in elections?
So Florida is a perfect case in point because the whiplash is extreme, right? So on the same day, you have the court both putting into place a 6-week abortion ban, right, which will go into place this month and pretty much eliminates the ability to obtain abortion legally in the state. In the same breath, they're allowing this ballot initiative for voters in November that could protect the access to abortion care up to the point of viability. So you literally have the court ruling on the same issue in two radically different ways on the same day. The fact that this is happening in Florida is particularly unique because I would say until a few weeks ago, maybe even a week ago, Democrats weren't really thinking of Florida as a swing state. And now it is, right? Because this abortion issue, particularly being on the ballot, is going to get voters to the polls. So really now Florida is up for grabs in a way that it wasn't just a week ago.
For a long time, I think it's fair to say conservatives considered abortion, anti-abortion platforms, a successful issue when they were running for office. It seems like things are different now post-Dobbs. What do you see changing?
I think it's really different. When we look at national polling, there a majority of Americans support access to safe abortion care, right? And post-Dobbs, what we saw is this issue come up again and again in state midterm elections, state ballot initiatives. And if you look at states like Kentucky and Kansas, places that you wouldn't necessarily expect support for abortion rights, when it came up on the ballot, abortion won, right? And it got voters out, and there were pro-choice votes essentially in every state where it came up on the ballot. The pro-choice advocates were able to garner a victory. So it has become a winning issue for Democrats in a way that it never was before. And I think that's really telling. I think we're also seeing Republicans take some pretty extreme positions that are out of touch with what the average American thinks should be the case with regard to healthcare. I think the recent events in Alabama are a perfect example of that.
Yeah, talk us through Alabama. That was one of the states we wanted to visit with you.
Oh, Alabama, yes. There's a lot going on in that state. So pretty recently, there was an Alabama Supreme Court decision that declared that under a state wrongful death statute, a frozen embryo, so that is an embryo that was not yet in anyone's body, was considered a minor or a person under state law. And as soon as that happened, every IVF clinic, every clinic in the state that was offering in vitro fertilization or IVF, they were immediately thrown into this situation where they didn't know if they would have criminal or civil liability if they continued with IVF procedures, because if an embryo is now a person, there's all sorts of new liability. So they faced that, and clinics began shutting down their IVF procedures overnight. And the state legislature and Republicans, I think, realizing what a losing issue this was, pretty quickly passed state legislation that negated some of the liability. But it didn't negate everything. Even this week, there have been hospitals in Alabama that have said by the end of the year, they will stop providing IVF procedures because they're fearful of liability. But this is an interesting twist. There was a special election in Alabama, I believe, just last week. And Alabama is a very red state. It has a supermajority of Republicans. And there was a special election, and a Democrat won. And it was a Democrat that had centered reproductive rights in her campaign. So it's a really interesting case study of a super red state with a very conservative court that ruled in a very conservative way, the legislature trying to backtrack, and then suddenly a pretty progressive Democrat winning a special election.
Jessica Waters is with us from American University, looking at abortion as an issue in the 2024 election campaign. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Suzanne is with us in Madison. Suzanne, hi.
Hi, thank you. I know in 2016, a great many Republicans voted for Trump specifically because of the abortion slash Supreme Court issue. It was their number one issue. It's been their number one issue since Roe v. Wade was passed in 72. I think that in this coming election, there's going to be a swing to the Democrats because nobody wants, not enough people in this country want a complete ban on abortion. A lot of people want some sort of a time limit in terms of duration of the pregnancy on abortion. And my feeling is that if 40 years ago there had been some compromise, none of this battle would ever have happened. I feel that compromise on this particular issue, like they do in Europe with the 15-week ban, many European countries have a 12, 14, 15-week ban on abortion, even though there are exceptions. And so that's where I think we have to go. Thank you for your time.
Suzanne, thanks a lot for the call. And Jessica, in a lot of polling, I think we often see in the news people who want complete bans on abortion and people who want very few limits on abortion. The majority of people, I think, in polling end up somewhere in the middle there. I mean, is it as simple as finding a midpoint and coming to an agreement on a compromise?
I think in some cases, so I think there's a couple things to unpack there, right? So the framework we had under Roe versus Wade and its progeny did allow for those compromises, right? Because the Roe framework said there was a fundamental right to abortion care, but it did not say that states could not have restrictions, that they could not have fetal viability restrictions, or they could not have things like parental involvement laws. And that at least struck some kind of compromise in a number of states. Now, without that federal protection and that recognition of the fundamental right, it has allowed states to go in the extreme direction of abortion bans. So I think one of the questions that we'll see is whether the people who, it wasn't their number one issue. So maybe it wasn't the Republican that abortion was their number one issue, or it wasn't a lifelong Democrat. I think what will be telling is the swing voters, the independent voters, the people who maybe reluctantly voted for one of the candidates or the other last time, they're going to be key to this. What we're not doing is talking to the base. We're talking to folks who could legitimately swing either way.
Suzanne, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Jessica Waters, assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University, talking about abortion and how it's showing up at 2024 election campaigns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the way both parties are talking about abortion? If you are a conservative, if you consider yourself pro-life, are you worried that some Republican candidates seem to be retreating from commitments to pro-life decision-making? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Jessica Waters from American University, looking at how politicians are talking about abortion in the lead up to the election and its role in the election campaign. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. In the post-Roe v. Wade world, do you want things left completely up to the states? Do you want some kind of new federal legislation on abortion? If so, what would you like to see that look like? And does this issue affect how you will vote in November? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jessica, I want to focus in on Republican candidates for the House and Senate this year. A lot of articles from various parts of the country, various states, saying, hey, this candidate had pre-Roe v. Wade been pretty firmly pro-life, now trying to moderate that message in different ways. What kind of things are you seeing out there?
Yeah, we have definitely seen some of that backtracking in key swing states, states like Arizona, states like Michigan, states like Pennsylvania. And, you know, I think what is happening is sort of picking up on the thread of the discussion earlier. Abortion used to be a winning issue for Republicans. And then post-Dobbs, I think Republicans tried to retreat a bit on those issues. They tried to make abortion not be the central issue in many of their campaigns. And that has proven to be a losing strategy, because every time it came up in a midterm or on a ballot, Republicans lost, right? And the pro-life side lost in all of those fights. And so now I think Republicans are struggling to find their footing. It's becoming pretty clear that coming out with an extreme anti-choice position is not going to win them any votes. But many of them have been on the record for years as supporting fetal personhood measures or supporting restricting the abortion right in some way. So now they're really having to toe the line. I think a lot of Republicans are hoping they can get away without talking about it too much. But that's proving hard when it's actually their abortion's actually going to be on the ballot in so many states.
I want to focus in on the Republican candidate for president. As a candidate back in 2016, Donald Trump had said, hey, I'm going to appoint Supreme Court justices who are going to overturn Roe v. Wade. He did that. They did that. Now the message is a little mixed. The campaign put out a statement this week. I'm going to quote from it. President Trump supports preserving life, but has also made clear that he supports states' rights because he supports the voters' right to make decisions for themselves. End quote there. The New York Times reported that former President Trump had privately expressed support for a federal 16-week ban. His campaign says no, fake news. What are you seeing from the Trump campaign on this issue?
I think the Trump campaign is all over the place on this issue. The most important thing that a president can do in terms of protecting individual liberties, including things like abortion rights, is the question of who they nominate for the Supreme Court, right? And who they support and nominate for federal judgeships. And Trump, when faced with that question, did, as you said, exactly what he said he was going to do and nominated multiple Supreme Court justices who were hostile to abortion rights. I think that is the most telling indication of what he will actually do if in office again. It's one thing to give a campaign speech and to sort of wiggle back and forth on the issue through a press release or talking points. It's a very different thing what you actually do when you have the office. And he's got a pretty clear track record on that.
Let's go back to our callers. Mary is with us in Northeast Wisconsin. Mary, hello.
Hi there. Good to talk to you about this topic. My concern is, of course, I'm always concerned about abortion rights, but I'm concerned about other things that go along with it, like the women's right to our own choice of medical care, because I think it goes past just being pregnant.
Mary, thanks for the call. That has been a concern that's come up, Jessica, that abortion restrictions have come along with other concerns about women's health care.
I think that's very true and a really important point. We tend to think about reproductive rights, that term, and abortion as synonymous. And of course, they are related. But there is a realm of reproductive health care that people need access to, whether that is things like sex education in schools, whether that is access to contraception, whether that is access to emergency contraception like Plan B, whether it is access to things like IVF. I really do believe, as the caller just said, that the range of reproductive health care is up for grabs here. And if there is one place of health care that is up for grabs, we have to at least be cognizant that that could have ramifications for health care outside of reproductive health care.
Thanks for that call, Mary. We'll go now to Charles in Greenfield. Charles, hi.
Hi, how's it going today? I wanted to give a comment about the fact that the Republicans kind of step into something that they can't get themselves out of. And they're trying to trick their voters to believe that they are going to support an issue when they are extremely far right and they're not going to support it. I think there should be some type of stipulations on how a person and why a person is going to get an abortion, and also they should have access to birth control. That should be a person's choice instead of restricting it altogether.
Charles, thanks a lot for the call. To Charles's first point, Jessica, the idea that Republicans have ended up in a spot that they don't quite know what to do with the end of Roe v. Wade.
I agree. And I think that was a really good way to put it. They are now in the position of oddly being on the defensive, right? And for years, it was Democrats that were on the defensive and had to figure out how to navigate this issue. Now Republicans are, and they are really being forced to explain their past track records on reproductive rights issues.
Thanks for that call. Turning to Democrats, from what you've been saying, it sounds like Democrats want to keep abortion front and center in this election campaign, and the polling seems to point in that direction. What are you seeing from Democratic candidates, Democratic strategies to try to make this a first and foremost issue in people's minds?
I mean, this is really the first time that I can remember that Democrats have made this such a central issue, both in state campaigns and in national campaigns. And I think they are very smartly following the polling. I think they realize that Republicans miscalculated in many of the extreme positions like bans, or Republicans have miscalculated when they start talking about things like birth control and emergency contraception. And I think Democrats, for really one of the first times, are seizing that opportunity.
Looking at what might happen in November, of course, we can't predict the future. Talking about abortion referenda, where that is the one issue up for grabs and people are voting for, that's one thing. When there's an election where, yes, abortion might be on people's minds and the economy and immigration and the list goes on, how do we know, how do we gauge whether abortion will rise to the top and be a deciding issue for those key swing voters you were talking about earlier?
That's the million-dollar question. I think the only evidence we have is what happened in the six or seven states where this came up in midterm elections, right? So we look at states like Vermont, California, Kansas, Michigan, Ohio, all of those states, when voters were forced to deal with the issue, voted in favor of abortion rights. We've also seen that in terms of when in Pennsylvania, there was a judge election, and the voters of Pennsylvania elected a pretty progressive judge, right? So every time it's come up, we're seeing victories for Democrats and pro-choice candidates. So I think that's the only real evidence we have that it will be a key deciding issue.
In our last half a minute or so, what are you paying attention to as the November election looms closer and closer?
I am paying attention to the states where it is not yet clear whether there will be a ballot, an initiative on the ballot. States vary in their procedures, right? So in some states, it is easier to get an initiative, a ballot initiative on the ballot. Other states, it is harder. And then there are some states where the only way that the law can change is through the legislative process. So I think really paying attention to those states where we think there will be a ballot initiative, but we're not yet sure, those will be predictive states.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jessica Waters, assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University. She talked to us about abortion and the November election. Wisconsin is not a state where it's easy to get ballot referenda on the agenda. The legislature didn't work to have a constitutional amendment. That's the only way we really get a binding referendum here in the state. Coming up Monday on Central Time, are people in Wisconsin excited about the election this year? Are they paying attention yet? Craig Gilbert is back with us for a look at what we know about voter enthusiasm here in the state. And there are concerns about loneliness in the U.S., especially coming out of the COVID pandemic. But that pandemic also brought people together in unique ways. We'll dig into our social connections, that and more, Monday on Central Time.